Welcome to the Jordan Phoenix Show. Thank you again for joining us. My guest today, none other than Mr. Nick Lambrew. Nicholas, thank you for being here.
You don't have a boo track, do you?
No, I have farts.
But oh, nice, that works.
I have plans to do more with the board, but I keep just getting... I think there's a lot of opportunity to have a really funny podcast where I actually take time to make a bunch of sound drops, but I just keep not doing it. So
that's all right. I remember I got to confess. I thought of that when I was listening to the show. I'm like, I need a boo track. You know?
I want to do like a ding, ding, ding and a buzzer and do contests and then like let the guests do them, you know, like, and I'll pitch ideas of like, is this a good idea? And then I don't know.
Anyway. Yeah.
Okay. Nick Lambrew, I need to introduce you to my listeners. Nick is many things, but most importantly to me was my role model in high school who became a director, a DP, a cinematographer, a documentarian, editor. Oh, fuck. Editor, yeah. Big. Yeah. Oh, a lot of editing. Moved out to LA when I was still in high school and was like, and you're a couple years older than me. And so I looked up to you in that way and was just like, people can actually get out. Like all the bands that we listened to always sung about, getting out of the Midwest, you know, mm-hmm. like, and then you were like, hey, I'm out of the Midwest. You moved and live with Story. Did you immediately move out and live in the Story of the Year house?
Yeah, I live with Story of the Year in Little Saigon. We had a really inexpensive house. It was like, at one point, there was like 14 of us living in a 3-bedroom.
Did you live with the guys in Adair too?
Yeah, after Story moved out, Adair came in, so.
Okay, yeah, that's wild. Man, so much like creativity in that house, huh?
Yeah, I actually, on one of my kind of, I don't know, adventures. I stumbled upon that house sort of like how, you know, Alex from A Clockwork Orange stumbles upon the house that he like vandalized like years
yeah.
ago.
Yeah.
And I knocked on the door and there was this dude and he had like this like Kiss tattoo, not the band, but like a lips
on his neck,
which I think is some kind of gang. And I talked to him for a while. I was like, you probably don't care, but there were a lot of good bands that came out of this house and, you know,
yeah. Page Avenue is probably written on that rooftop, right?
Yeah, it was actually. I mean, Anthem of Our Dying Day, I think was yeah. the lyrics were about sitting on the roof there.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's actually written back into one of my screenplays. So, you know, and that's a whole topic maybe we could or couldn't, may or may not get into, but if it gets produced, that house could probably get a little bit more recognition and you know, become more credible or famous than it already is. It's not famous.
On the Hollywood tour thing, they're like, and here's where a band, some emo bands from 2005 recorded.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of emphasis on that house by like the guys in the band and like people that we know. But, yeah. You know, outside of that, and it's not like there were a whole lot of like crazy things that happened there. I know Story of the Year built this really cool, practice space in the garage.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was pretty amazing that they just like, you know, they have those kind of skills where they could just build stuff. And, you know, I can't do that. For me, like, I'm like a kid that believes in religion, that God created everything. Because, yeah. like, if I try to figure out how things work, it's just not going to happen. So I just, like, accept. It's like, well, that's a, you know,
that's the way it's
that's a brand new yeah. cement, like, barrier on the highway. And it's like, God made that. People didn't make that. God made that.
Okay. So you are in LA and you're basically like kind of like been messing around in like iMovie and Final Cut. But like, I mean, you know, well, no.
iMovie. I mean, iMovie was like high school.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like we were like in high school working on that stuff. And then you like, did you do the Adair video before you moved out there?
No. So, when I first moved out there, I was enrolled in school and I was going to be studying film, and through Story of the Year, I met John Feldman.
Right.
And John Feldman, he saw some of my stuff. We were talking in the back of a tour bus at K-Rock Weenie Roast. And he was like, "Hey, you wanna edit some stuff for my band?" So I was like, "Yeah." So he gave me a bunch of tapes, and I
Goldfinger,
yeah, his band, it was the first video I made was Too Many Nights off of Disconnection Notice, and they liked it, so they.
And you were like pretty green at this point, right? Like you hadn't done. Definitely, no, like, that I knew was a huge edit. Opportunity.
I was, like, slowly building my arsenal of, like, I was still on an iMac, and I was, like, you know, after each video I did, it was, like, okay, now I have a G5, now I have a nice monitor, now I have, like,
oh, yeah, each time you get paid, you're, like, time to upgrade the
gear.
They
didn't even pay me. I think John Feldman gave me his, like, Apple monitor as payment for that video.
Sure.
So I was, like, that's cool, you know? But, yeah. But, you know, it's a shame. A lot of those videos that I started doing, and even the ones that... Even some of the really big ones, like the record companies, they uploaded them in like the lowest possible quality.
Because they're we don't want people to steal them. We want people to buy the DVD. So, yeah.
Well, if that's the reasoning, that's cool. But I just feel like they don't know what they're doing.
Probably a mix. Yeah. Yeah, because you go back now and it's like, yeah, these incredible videos kind of like, look like shit because they're just like 480 or whatever.
Yeah, well, know? I mean, like, I'll go back and visit those on YouTube and I'll be like, cool, I can't wait to see the comments. Maybe, you know, usually when somebody sees a nice video, they talk about the song or the band, but I always love if somebody makes a comment about the video and the director.
Right.
But all that's written about, like, Wasted and Too Many Nights and I Want, which were the three songs I made videos for on Disconnection Notice. You know, the only comments are like, if there were, if I would have a penny for every pixel in this video, I'd have a penny or something, you know, something stupid like that. You know, it's like, I don't know the lowest quality video. It's like 180. It's like, we meet again, you
know?
Right. And like, nobody talks about the actual video, whether it's cool or not. It's just, it's so distracting of how low quality it is.
Right. Yeah. That's fair. I mean, I can't imagine trying to appreciate a video when it's like unwatchable.
It's a shame, you know? And if they were to re-upload it, they'd lose like, I don't know, some of those videos only have like 16,000, but, you know, that it would still suck to lose all those views if they re-uploaded it, but they're not going to re-upload it. And I don't know.
That's shitty. Yeah.
So anyway, that was, you know, the first few videos were Goldfinger videos.
So you're doing Goldfinger videos, and then what's the next? When does the Adair video, the Diamond Ring, that if you haven't seen the Diamond Ring video.
Prepare for low quality video.
Really? Is it low quality too?
Well, I think there's so much movement in the video that the compression on the, I mean.
You don't have the original? It's like when it came out, I was like, oh, Nick is like a Hollywood director. Cause it was
that's ridiculous.
Well, I mean, I was a kid too, but
it was, I mean, it's a shame because I'm plagued by the legacy of low quality videos.
Right.
I'm plagued by that.
Yeah.
And
cause you came at a time when like DSLRs didn't exist.
Yeah.
When LED lights didn't exist.
Well, I mean, we were uploading videos to YouTube when they didn't upload high res videos. You had to compress your video so that it was small enough to be uploaded on.
Yeah.
And like when you'd have a lot of editing in your video, like compression works in a way where it takes redundant information and it only includes the movement, and anything that's redundant from one frame to another, it copies it.
Right.
So, it's like when you have a lot of movement, there's not a lot of redundant information.
Yeah, because everything's new and you have higher. Yeah.
So I mean, so those videos looked, you know, they had to be a really large file size because there was a lot of movement.
Right.
And
so you had to compress the shit out of it just to get it on there.
They looked terrible, and it was because YouTube was like just starting off at that time, and they didn't let you upload any size video. You had to compress it and upload it like. Within their terms, you know?
Yeah. Well, okay. If you don't watch it, let me just it's Nick basically found this super cool garage or basement like looking kind of place.
Well, it's actually like it's downtown. It's right next to Busch Stadium. I don't know.
But yeah. Anyway, like an industrial looking space, and that had just like kind of all this garbage kind of laying around in it, like cool like old metal parts and stuff, and basically does this stop motion music video of like this machine falling in love with this girl, and like it was just like the most, I mean, it kind of like had some Tool elements to it, and like
it did, yeah,
but like for me, just was like
a perfect circle. It was a mix circle. Between the Judith video and like a Tool video. But
anyway, it was just so well done, at least in my mind from back then. Like, so I don't know, just like a beautiful story and like clever. And like, I couldn't believe that I knew a dude that did that, you know? So
thanks, man. Well,
it was cool.
Yeah. I actually, you know, the story is a symbol of high school relationships.
Right.
And it really is a metaphor for how when you're in high school, you're like in a pond, and like everybody gets to know each other. And so it starts off with the girl locked in a boiler room. And so that's kind of like a metaphor for being in a pool, a gene pool. And so out of loneliness, she creates a relationship. She builds a robot to fall in love with her.
Right.
And that's kind of symbolic of the fact that, like, you know, a girl just she may not really be in love, but she may be bored or lonely. So so she just like creates something.
Right.
So I mean, eventually, long story short, the door opens in the boiler room and she leaves, and he's sort of created for this
for
relationship.
Her, and she's gone.
And she's gone, so he has no one left to love. So that's kind of symbolic of how, like, after high school, you know, there's a bigger pool. Like, you had to compete with all the guys with money, all that stuff, and she's gone, and you're left feeling this emotion because she built you.
Right.
And, you know, in the video, he tries to make his own little robot. And, you know, I mean,
I love that. the little robot that he makes is so cute.
Well, like, I mean, it's kind of stupid. I've had a reaction. It's like in LA when I played it for people, they kind of laughed at it. And I was like, fuck you guys. You know?
Well, it was like funny in a sweet way. And then ultimately, I mean,
when
in
he
a sad
falls
way.
Off the table, it's like, it's meaningless. I mean, I was trying to think of what would have been better there, which is maybe that he like just pushes him off or something.
No, I loved it just like as it was. It was perfect.
Well, thanks, man. I mean, it's a really, you know, it starts off really dark, and we didn't have a whole lot of lighting. Like, we had basically we shot the thing in my dad's hospital boiler room. He has a hospital at this small town called Chaffee in southeast Missouri, and it's gone now. But I was up for 2 weeks every night from like, you know, sundown to like sunrise, just in this boiler room in the middle of nowhere, like
moving things like incrementally,
slightly moving them and taking a picture and then moving them again.
And had you done any stop motion stuff, or was this your first?
No, and it was a miracle. my friend Tim Bogeman actually helped me build the dolls.
They were so cool.
Well, it was a challenge. Those things are like 4 feet tall.
Really?
And they stand on their own and they move anywhere you want to move them. And that was a freaking miracle.
Right. Like a feat in itself.
Like, there's so many things that can go wrong that when you're ambitious, you don't care. And maybe that kind of battles the problems that come up.
Right.
But you don't really realize that like things can really go wrong and you could be like, you could fail.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it was a miracle that video wasn't exactly a huge success, but I mean, cause like, again, it was low quality and there was a lot of like broken video. Like, I used broken VHS camcorders.
The band was also not like, I mean, they weren't even signed yet. And then when Rob was on the last episode, 2 episodes ago, was like, and our label was like, kind of like, here's some money for your album and you get to be on Warped Tour. And that's where we stopped helping you. So they didn't have label. You didn't have label push for the video either.
They had $5,000 for us, which is not, you know, I mean,
it's a lot now.
It is a lot now. Then.
It's insane that you,
it is a lot now, but you know, they used to have $1 million videos back in the day.
Yeah.
And you know, if I had $1 million for a video, I'm not sure what I would even come up with. I'd probably pockets. I'd actually most get paid. I wouldn't get most of it, but I'd actually pay myself from a video. Cause I've never made money off a video. The budgets have always been so low that I always put everything
spend
in the video.
Budget. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, that video, I had broken VHS cameras and I, you know, VHS hadn't really been revisited, in that time, like it was like television and HD, and like VHS was kind of forgotten about.
Right. So now it's kind of like come back and
it has come back.
Then it was kind of
And it's weird. I hate to think that. I feel like broken VHS became a signature of my videos, which I didn't really like because, you know, I mean, when it may have a cool effect, but I feel like people want to see something really rich and crisp, you know?
Right.
And like, you know, thank God the cell phone videos came out, because you can watch all my videos in a cell phone. It looks fine because it's small and it like, you can't, it doesn't need to have a high resolution.
Yeah. Cause it's on a small
screen. But like
screen.
People are out there and they try to watch something on their HD TV and all of my work just looks terrible on television.
Right. And it, so you don't have like the hard drives anymore?
I have them, but my mom threw away all the adapters, so I don't have any plugs to
turn
on. Oh my
god! Let's make that a project. We'll like go on eBay and like
value your time, Jordan. You got better things,
dude. I would love just for the diamond ring alone, just to have like a HD version of that, and then I could just put directed by Jordan Phoenix on there instead. that's worth my time.
There's so many videos. I think what's best is that the. You know, my dream, so...
Don't go too far ahead. What happens after Adair? What's the next step? Where do we go from there?
Well, before Adair was Deftones.
Oh, yeah, live coverage of Deftones.
Well, gave me, like, so I had done the Goldfinger thing, and Deftones were on Maverick Records, which was Madonna's label.
Which is like Feldman had a direct connection to.
Feldman was really connected.
On them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So... But I remember they called me up. They're like, hey, you know, you're going to do a DVD for the Deftones. And I'm like, you know, I mean, not a lot of people necessarily know. I think if you listen to Adrenaline, their first album, you can really get an appreciation of how genius that band was, especially lyrically and riff-wise.
Of course.
It's unbelievable. But, you know, not a lot of people are big into the Deftones these days of younger generations, but...
Well, I guess I'm too old.
I'm gonna
know
gossip.
What the kids are.
I'm gonna take this opportunity to gossip about some of the bands. I think Chino is, you know, last time I saw him, he sounded great, but you know, his vocal cords are destroyed.
You think?
And it really destroys. Like, I think it ruins the Deftones for younger generations when they see him live and they hear Chino's vocals, because.
Last time I saw him, I thought they were killer, but...
Yeah, I mean, I saw him, 2007 maybe, after I did the DVD, and he sounded awesome.
Yeah. That's the last time you saw him?
Yeah.
Oh, 12 years ago. Okay.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, just some of the videos online, you know, his vocals, like if you listen to Around the Fur...
Yeah.
And... the first record, Adrenaline,
mm-hmm.
like the way he sounds is so awesome, but you hear him live, it's disappointing. And that was one of the problems that I had to face when I was editing the DVD was basically they gave me a lot of live footage. I skipped the part where I went to Warner Brothers and met with Abe Cunningham, the drummer, and Steph Carpenter, the guitar player. And that was one of the best days of my life because Deftones were...
I remember driving around... during lacrosse practice, before lacrosse practice with you, and you're like, what do you know about Deftones? And I'm like, I'm pretty hip to it. And you're like, what's your favorite song? And I was like, all of them, because I didn't know. You introduced me to Deftones, and I was so like excited for you being stuck here, and like I'm like, there's like my, you know, high school crush, like, working on this band that you told me, like, it was my favorite band. There's like, listen to this.
Yeah. I mean, driving home from that interview with
that
my
and
box
Tool,
of
we
tapes,
would listen to just
yeah,
Tool
well, Tool,
and
Lateralis is probably one of the best heavy albums. You know, there's heavier music now, and there's like,
oh, I know it's become ridiculous where
it's
like,
hard for Tool to stay the heaviest band, but like they were the heaviest band,
yeah.
But they were also, musical geniuses.
Yeah. They were like, they're like weird and like, and like, yet they were poppy in a sense. Like, you know what I mean? Like, they had like pop, like hooks and stuff. But then they were like also.
It was my first introduction to like math metal. You know?
Sure, right.
Because like the time signatures, and I was big into drums and you know rhythms. And that album was just like brilliant. You know,
yeah.
The Grudge. I remember going to the concert and seeing it live, and it was just like you get chills. I mean, everyone could say that about their favorite band, but. You know, Tool, I think, is struggling to compete with a lot of heavier bands because Korn and Deftones and Tool were the heaviest bands right. that existed.
Right.
You know, there were underground bands, but there wasn't the internet back then.
Right.
So they were like the mainstream, like they were the heaviest bands coming out of the mainstream world. And like there's heavier bands now. And
you can't
really expect Tool and Korn. And I feel like Korn wrote a really heavy album that's awesome.
Yeah.
The new album is badass.
Yeah.
But like, you know, like when I watch Korn and I watch videos of Korn, all I see is a bunch of people cheering to a bunch of people who are like, we're going to fucking kill ourselves. You know, like
yeah.
it doesn't match. You
right.
can't party in front of somebody who's like suffering and like trying to be as nice as possible to be a really cool celebrity, you know, and be
right.
cool.
Right.
But like they got issues. And if they want to be like, fuck this, you know, if that makes them feel better, I think as fans, we should encourage that because I mean, it just makes it's just sad to see, you know, I mean, Head probably went like became Christian to save his life. You know,
I saw him. I don't know how, but I saw him on an episode of the with Pat Roberts, the 700 Club. I had it on. It's like the right. That's the name of
was
Pat
he with
Roberts.
His daughter.
No, he's so the 700 Club is like on like channel. I don't know. 12 or something. And it's like that, it's like that, born again, like Pat Roberts. That's his
oh,
name, right?
okay. He's so like, oh, it was Roberts. A Christian guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And they were like, here we have Head. He was from a band called, Korn.
Yeah.
And then he was on there and he was like, yeah, I just found God. And I was just like partying and like different girl every night doing lots of drugs. And I don't know. It was just like, it felt really exploitative of his story and like, also the super lamest way to, I just
well,
felt like
it's like people almost for I mean they've still maintained a huge audience I'm sure around the world but like they're hardcore followers that were into like that like Korn because it was the heaviest fucking music they've ever heard
right
you know a lot of that core fan base and their first album the one with you know Blind is was heavy at the time but like now it's not that heavy
right
but yeah. they have like songs on there I think one was called Helmet in the Bush where it's just like metal and there's just like oh
yeah.
like, do you ever
yeah.
see outside the line something like that I don't know they had heavy songs on there but you know they're not the heaviest band anymore
well yeah cuz now yeah and they
people
inspired a generation to become like oh that's what you think heavy is and like we can go way slower
yeah,
and way
so,
chuggier
and so they're kind of being they kind of like lost a lot of their core fan base
yeah
and you know that's like you know it's hurtful I mean there's a lot of rock stars that you know, Chester and, you know, a lot of, you know, Kurt Cobain, you look at those guys on interviews and you're just kind of like, cool, it's Kurt Cobain. But he, in his head, he's like, I'm going to fucking kill myself.
Right.
That's
There's
serious.
A lot of hurt behind their, yeah, their eyes.
That's a serious deal. And like Korn, I feel like is a band that maybe is going through that and nobody really knows or cares because they're trying to be the best guy. They're trying to be good people and all this stuff to their fans. But you know, I feel, and I could be totally wrong. They could just be totally fine and like great on life, but
sure.
But I think it's really twisted to be a rock star entertaining people while you're going through something like that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, though, it seems like pain is one of the ways that creates a lot of really great art, you know?
It does. That's what happened on Wolves.
right.
I mean, Dan's lyrics on that were like
super, yeah.
And it's a shame because they're so, like, you know, when you suffer and you create art, it's like it has more substance to it.
Right.
But, like, I don't know how many Story of the Year fans are out there suffering and relating to that, which is a shame because
there's probably some, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because, like, it'd be a shame to see, like, such, you know, I don't know what the word would be. Not dark lyrics, but, like, you know, painful lyrics.
Yeah.
And your audience is all like, you know, driving around in, you know, SUVs and going to parties and all this stuff. And, you know, I'm worried that nobody's going to listen to Dan's lyrics and relate to that. But I did. I was going through, I was locked up. I was in a step down facility after being in an IMD, which is a lockdown psych hospital for a year. And that's kind of personal, but I'll throw it out there. I went through, you know, we can talk about it later, about sort of my mission to make an independent film and get into film festivals. You know, I put myself through a lot of hell.
Yeah.
Sort of in search of something interesting to talk about.
Yeah.
Because, like, if you're basically a writer and you live in your, you know, your bedroom and you're trying to write, you really have to be an expert on something.
Yeah.
And even if you're an expert on something, you're not really engaging in something that's a story. How are you going to tell a story when you don't have a story?
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, you can make up something, but an idea is only, a concept is only so much of a story idea. The yeah. rest of it, you have to have events, and those events have to be driven through dialogue, and the dialogue has to move the story along. And it's like, you know, you can write that off the top of your head, but you'd be the fucking smartest person in the fucking world, and you deserve to be, I mean, it's not that easy to do it with that. So my approach toward getting like a good story, you know, my life got difficult and I capitalized off. I'm not going to say the bad stuff that happened in my life was like me trying to make a screenplay.
Yeah.
But I definitely capitalized off of the things that were happening to me.
Well, before we go there, I want to introduce that, because I think that's a really powerful time, but I want to get some other.
Well, chronologically, you're talking about wolves.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to, okay. So basically, a crazy lineup of like awesome artists that you're working with. You worked with Deftones, you worked with Story, you worked with Used, Goldfinger.
I made a DVD for The Used called Birth, and it's really low quality on Amazon right now. You can stream the documentary part. I wish they would make what you made for me, which was a box set of all my work.
Yeah.
And at the time, it didn't make sense, I guess, to the companies, because the directors that had box sets were like, you know,
Chris Cunningham.
And, yeah. And like, there's not a bunch of shitty videos that are like, you know, behind the scenes videos that are really funny, but you know, I mean, it's like second string, you know,
yeah.
You don't want to put, it's not like, it's not the main course.
Right.
But like now with the internet, I feel like having a collection of a lot of my videos would make sense, but it'd be a licensing issue and it'd be a nightmare. But
I know. Well, and it's, yeah. And the lack of quality issue is like,
well, the actual shame. Videos I made are not low quality.
No, that's what I'm saying. The having them, like having access to them, even aside from licensing it, it's like they're trapped on hard drives, or, you know what I mean? Like, it's not like,
well, they're in the vaults in the record companies.
Well, yeah.
So I delivered finished products to them on DigiBeta, which is like a high definition digital video, like tape, I guess. I don't know how they do it these days. They might have like, you know, flash drives that store them on like a hard drive that's like, I don't know, who knows? They might not have a tape library anymore.
Yeah. But okay. All right. Okay. So who let's go into talking. I feel like
after The Used, I mean, there was Bullets and Octane, which nobody really, I mean, they're a really underrated band.
Oh, they got a new album coming out. Do you see that? They're doing, recording a new album.
I hope so.
Isn't
I
that mean, wild?
Gene is very, you know, I didn't really appreciate Bullets and Octane's music as much until I got into lyrics and writing lyrics.
Yeah.
And like Gene's lyrics are really, you know, strong, and, you know, he has a little bit of like a, kind of a, you know, a religious topic sometimes.
Yeah.
Which I think appeals to a lot of people. Like, you know, you listen to a band like Slayer and they have religious themes.
Sure.
And that, I feel like religious themes are lyrically some of the most powerful things you can talk about. That's why, like, listening to Slayer originally when I wasn't into lyrics, I was like, okay, this is kind of like dark, and the lyrics carry the feeling of the music, and if you're not paying attention to the words, you know. But Gene's a very talented singer, and the Caving In music video I made for them was
so good. I loved it.
Well, it was a very difficult day. I think the guy that operated the cranes in the video shoot, you know, I ended up working myself basically to madness, because I was kind of in an unsustainable environment, and, you know, I needed to keep going to keep the things that I had in my life. And so I basically worked myself to the brink of insanity. But, you know, I mean, on the caving
was
in it, video
was shoot. That the, what was the video or what was the project that you felt
like to the edge at? Of the earth by 30 seconds to
yeah,
Mars.
Fuck. Okay. So yeah, I don't want to skip. Yeah. I don't want to skip ahead from, but let's skip ahead. Okay. Cause well, Bullets and Octane was incredible. And did you feel like that?
Well, I was going to say
video
that,
the
that,
start
that
of
guy,
like,
the, there were guys on that shoot that day that went insane.
Really?
And they like, they, for all I know, are batshit crazy and like, you know, drooling, staring at the wall for the rest of their life because of that video
that
shoot.
That one project?
Yeah. I mean, wow. it was the most stressful, horrible day ever. And we shot that video. There were a lot of setups. And we shot that whole, I mean, you wouldn't appreciate it maybe unless you were a production manager
yeah.
who would take the money and like know how much money it costs to set up each scene.
What was the budget for that video?
$15,000.
Damn.
Sony put up the money, and I mean, the guy who signed Tool was there. He was trying to talk to me during the day, and I was like trying to assure him that things were going okay, but like everything was like a nightmare.
Yeah.
And he was like, okay, you know, I'm not here to micromanage. I'll let you go. But you know, we shot from 8 a.m. to like 4 a.m. the next day.
Jeez.
And it when you look at the video. You know, you may not appreciate, like, you may not understand, like, how much we did in such a short amount of time. You know, there was there's an explosion in that video
yeah.
that was stock footage. It cost me like $2,000 for 10 seconds of video because they knew that if I wanted to blow up a car, it was going to cost me more than $2,000. So they got away with charging me $2,000 for a 10-second clip.
Right.
Just fun stuff like that, but I mean, there's probably a lot to talk about with that video, but we can move ahead to
well, the Jared Leto stuff is, I feel like that's when it really gets juicy and interesting. And because I, you know, Bullets is like, obviously like I love Bullets, but like a lot of people don't know that, but everybody knows 30 Seconds to Mars. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So when did your bromance with Jared Leto start? How'd that happen?
I was on tour on Taste of Chaos and we were in Detroit and it was, I had made, internet kind of episodes for each of the bands on the tour. And it was time to do 30 Seconds to Mars's episode. And I remember in the morning I was freaking out because like the day was getting away and like, I was like, okay, this is a big deal. I got to really perform, but like, I don't have any footage and I don't know where he is. Like Jared's a very exclusive person.
Yeah.
And you know, you hear that word thrown around in Hollywood, the most exclusive clubs, all this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But it means basically that you're out.
Cause he's like he's got one foot in the music world, but one foot in the video world. Like right. Like, I mean, I feel
so
like
it was hard to get a hold of him, but their camera guy that they had with them on tour said, okay, I'm going to introduce you to him. So I get on the bus and he's sitting there and he's kind of like, you know, so what's the deal, man? And I'm like, well, you know, I'm hired by this tour to produce videos for each of the bands, and I'm just getting a little worried because like the day's going away and I don't have anything. I'd be really happy if I just filmed anything,
yeah,
and just had something to work with, and I, you know, forget if it's gonna be great or anything, but I need something. So he was like, okay. So we filmed basically.
What were you feeling in that moment? Were you like excited and nervous? Like, oh, this will be great. Or were you
you know, I mean, in some ways, my interaction with Jared Leto was very damaging to my soul.
Yeah, but in that moment, though, before...
Well, I still was basically myself, and I was like, you know, I was talking to him, and there was a moment where he was just, like, silent, you know, and he wasn't going to respond.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, so what next? And then it just kind of comes up, and like, okay, yeah, you know, then he kicks in, and he's like, he's just a normal guy then.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's this, like, barrier around him where he's got this shield where he'll just, like, you know... shut you out.
Right. And wait for you to just like let yourself out and then you just stay there and just wait for him to like look up and be like, okay, you're through the force field.
Yeah. Can we edit that out?
Yeah. I'm going to amplify it.
Hear all the juices in my lungs.
All the juices, the lung juices.
Anyway, so
do you think, is that when you guys had kind of a connection where he was like,
well, I made the videos like I basically had access to them and like filming them, and I made, you know, these MySpace videos. Mm-hmm. I was not good at like titling things, so I called it Tour Diaries on MySpace, and that was on their main page. Later, I thought I think the better word for it would have been tour video than diary, because I was like, diary.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's just bad English.
Sure.
It's bad titling. But I made those videos for them, and those are pretty popular. I recommend if somehow you can, like, you know.
Welcome to your MySpace account.
Yeah, blow the dust off your MySpace account and search for Taste of Chaos Tour Diaries 2007, 30 Seconds to Mars, Seosin, and Senses Fail.
Oh, cool.
Those were really good videos. I made 3 videos each for them, and they were, you know, it's not cinematic, but it's kind of like television, internet television.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. It was like the birth of internet television.
Before that was like a thing.
And there's still not, too much internet television like what was happening. But yeah, I mean, in some ways I felt like I pioneered internet TV.
Yeah. You were definitely like on the brink of the switch of like the DSLR revolution and like all, well, you know.
DSLR, I mean, it's cool. I mean, you know, everybody's got camera phones now on their phones, like iPhone 11.
But I just mean that switch where there was like, and DSLRs, I feel like, are the line in the sand of like when it became like, oh, you can get
internet world.
Yeah, you can get something that looks really good that has all these features that like film cameras and like the old, you know, video cameras didn't have. And it, anyway, it all came swirling in, and I feel like DSLRs were the catalyst that made everything so inexpensive.
Yeah,
and,
I mean, I'm sort of relieved I don't have a DSLR, because I'm like on this like
Don't go there. Well, okay. Let's keep going. Okay,
so I did those videos for them.
Yeah,
you could check them out if you want to. They turned out pretty cool, but they're internet videos. They're not like movies or television.
Sure.
So Jared came up to me and he's like, look, you know, we want you to go on our world tour. Like, how much do you want? And I was negotiating my own, salary.
Yeah.
It's not a salary. It's like a
project fee or whatever.
Whatever.
How long was the tour going to be for? Do you remember?
2 months.
Okay. So he's like, how much do you want for 2 months of?
Yeah. And I was ecstatic, but I had a falling out with my manager. And he's a great guy. If he's listening, you know, it's a shame. That's a whole long story of what happened there. But I was on my own to negotiate my own wages.
Gotcha.
So I was like, I want $7,000 each month.
Sure.
And he was like, ooh, you know, that's kind of steep. And, you know, I think his attitude was like, I didn't think that was unreasonable.
No.
Because like, you know, I mean, maybe it's more than, but like, you know, As a freelancer, you don't know how long you're going to have to go without without work. So $7,000 could last you the next 3 months.
Right. It's a lot if you're making that consistently, but it's not a lot of, you know, $14,000 and then work for three or four months.
Yeah, like, basically, yeah. You know.
Yeah.
So I thought that was reasonable, but I think he had this kind of attitude. He had this like, you know, Howard Hughes attitude, which was like, if I'm going to pay that much, I'm going to work you twice as hard or something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I'll get you for half price or whatever.
Right.
So
did he take the bait? $7,000?
So I was in. And, yeah. And you know, it was kind of weird because I was kind of at the end of my ropes in terms of like, you know, I used to be in my apartment. I had my video editing company. It was in Venice Beach on the beach. And, you know, I was used to being in front of a computer, not sleeping. So like to pick up a camera and carry like luggage that like camera cases and my suitcase and be ahead of the band all the time.
Yeah.
Was like something that really was like, you know, difficult. And in some ways it puts me off the deep end a little bit. Cause I was like, I wasn't used to
you kind of got comfortable being like by yourself or like with a roommate. And
yeah.
Like,
well, I was exhausted even at before I started, but anyway, so we went out there and, you know, I mean, those guys were, they were different than any people I'd ever met.
I remember you telling me that they were like, Jared in particular was like, didn't have the kind of sense of humor that any of that you were familiar with, and like,
well, it was,
you would make jokes
to me.
And he would just stare at you like,
well, I didn't even make jokes. I was just kind of, well, my job was to basically just film him all the time, which I thought was ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, like who's going to want to see just Jared like getting his makeup done for 2 hours.
Right.
And I'm filming that. And I'm like, well, so like,
cause he's like, oh, I'm paying you. So,
well, they told me specifically to film all day, every day.
Wow.
And so I had gone there with the impression that I'm going to film the shows, get some action of the fans and all this stuff and the cool stuff. But I went to put my camera away in Scotland, and Shannon, the drummer, was like, he's like, we want you to film everything. So I was like, okay, you know, and I picked it up. And so in some ways that destroyed my relationship, having a relationship with Jared that was sane, because like there was a barrier of the camera, and he's kind of, he has a different attitude than anyone I've ever met. And it sort of made me feel like not social with him.
Yeah. Cause there's like this piece of like technology between you guys.
That and even when it was like time to put it down, I was like, well, what do I say now? You know? So it so really
you spent all this time with them not saying
it was
anything.
Really awkward, you know?
Yeah.
And, but I watched him, like my job was basically to watch him for 2 months from every day from 12 in the, or like, you know, 8 a.m. to like midnight.
Yeah.
And, you know, there wasn't too much interaction with the camera, which I was kind of like, how dare you not address my camera, you know? But he's Jared Leto, so it was kind of one of those things where, you know, I was kind of interested in like...
He seems like he always is interacting with the world like he has a camera on him anyway, you know?
He's an actor.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a professional actor, and he's a dramatic actor.
Right, right.
And that's one of those things that really was about him that really kind of made me say, you know, here I am, like, I come from St. Louis, and, like, me and my friends, you know... We never really had, like, I never really was, like, it's weird. It's not like I had this, like, dream of succeeding.
Right.
But it was like I had this energy about me that was making me successful. But it was all comedy. Like, we were geniuses of comedy.
Yeah. Being silly and, like, I mean, that was, like, that's, I think, what drew me to you so much in high school and, like, looking up to you is, like, I'm, like, this dude's like running the lacrosse program and he's like super silly. And we have like this, we had like a editing class together or something with Donley, and you just like not show up and this, and they like the school would like give you shit and you'd be like, I
had senioritis really bad when I knew you.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I was kind of on my own in the media room, like teaching myself. Like, right.
But it's like people are like, you need to do this, this, and this. And you're like, no. I'm just going to do this and I'm going to be fine. You know, like.
Well, I mean, before then, I was on good terms. Like, I had a good relationship with all my teachers. And I think in the end of it, like, the media professors, or not professors, but the teachers were kind of like, all right, well, this is it for him. Here's an Apple computer and Final Cut Pro and a camera and, like, good luck, you know?
Right.
But,
Well, just that everybody would let you get away with being a shit because you're like such
well, we
a
were geniuses.
Well, likable.
Like, there's something about our high school. A lot of people came from you had Jason Davis, who played for, he was a starting running back for like New York. I'm not sure which team, either the Giants or the Jets. We had a baseball player, Josh Altman, who was the pitcher for the Athletics. And I did just, Bruce Franks, he became a politician. You know, he's got a short documentary right now that is like on the list of Oscars that may win an Oscar.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many people that came from our high school that did well. Like my friend Dan Franz, he's working in the Pentagon.
And it seemed like that kind of thing inspires the underclass to like, oh, I could do that. I mean, that's, you know, like everything that I'm doing now, honestly, like is directly related to like what you were doing, like me looking up to you. I made a fucking box set DVD as a college project.
That was
like,
the greatest gift I've ever got. And I was just like, I wish this was real and being sold in stores.
I know. You told me, you're like, I think we're going to get this made. And I was like, let me know. I'll go to the project.
You know,
twice.
I mean, a lot of the bands, when they see like a video job, it's like, you know, a lot of the money goes to the bands and stuff. So even if I did have a DVD box set, it was like, it would be a nightmare. But the point is that when I, you know, we were geniuses in high school, but we were comedians and we were just playing around. And that's not really very, safe for your future, you know?
Right. Oh, yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
We were going in entertainment, so it was like, you know, we were going to go for it.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, you make a living as a class clown.
Right.
You're kind of fucked.
Well, maybe.
But, well, here's the thing. Here's what happened. So I went out to California with this, like, doctorate in comedy. Me and my friends were, like, studying everything. We were always asking, why is that funny?
Right.
What is that about that makes that funny?
Yeah.
And we turned it into a philosophy, which is, I'm not sure why they don't have any philosophy classes on humor, because it's a big topic and it's mysterious to me. Why do we laugh? You know,
it's, well, it's like almost like learning the recipe ruins the result. You know, something about not knowing the recipe that makes things so funny.
I mean, I thought it was empowering to know why something might be funny.
Yeah, yeah. But at some point there's like some kind of, it's like if it's all science and no magic, then it's like not as special, you know?
Yeah, I mean, St. Louis is a very, it's a beautiful place. Like I've been on the outskirts, like I've been living in Pasadena, California. My dad lives in Cape Girardeau, so I'm kind of like on the outs of St. Louis. But every time I come here, it's like I always find myself like hardened by the other worlds I'm living in.
Yeah.
But when I come here, it's like everybody speaks the same language as I do.
Yeah.
And it's like we're laughing and it's like, oh, I'm not laughing like fake at this joke. Like it's actually legitimately funny.
Yeah.
And like I feel good right now and I don't feel like I'm not being a fool by laughing. It's like we just have a good time. And I would say it's because the city is so fucking dangerous that if you don't like laugh and have a good time, like somebody's going to fucking kill you. So I don't know. That's my theory about St. Louis, but I love being back here.
Yeah.
But basically, so I went out there with a doctorate in comedy, you know, and I met Jared Leto. He said something to me one day at his house, which is like right next to the Vivid headquarters, like a porn star.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like in the Hollywood Hills. And he told me, he's like, you're really big into comedy, right? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, I got one word for you, drama. And I was like, I felt like he kind of like understood that that I would take that seriously. But you know, it really fucked me up because drama is not like comedy.
Right. They're like diametrically.
Drama is fights and suffering and hell and everything that has anything to do with like stuff that you don't naturally want to go toward.
Right.
So, you know, like on the tour, I sort of became serious because I was watching him and he's successful. And I wanted to take as much as from him as I could.
Yeah, so you're like sort of mirroring his.
And I'm trying to understand why he's doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like there's part of me that's like wanting to be like doing what he's doing.
Yeah.
But part of me wants to know like I was in the clue. I was in the dark as to why I had to act that way or why he was acting that way.
Right.
And, you know, that was a difficult thing. And, you know, I was on. We went to Greenland and we shot a video on an iceberg. Yeah. I mean. It was dangerous because I had just got off the world tour and I was tired.
Right.
I was like physically exhausted. I didn't have time to look at porn like I'm used to. So I'm like struggling on this place and we're going to Greenland now and we're getting off a boat onto an iceberg and we're taking helicopters into Swiss cheese ice that could take you in a river down into who knows where.
There's like no daylight or there's no nighttime, right? It's like crazy.
Well, it went dark really late, but there was nighttime. Like we went there in the summer. So I guess the sun was up a lot later, but we were only there for like 3 days. You
okay,
know?
Okay.
So it seems like this big epic adventure, but it was 3 days of our lives, and there's so much more that happens outside of that it's like, who cares about that anymore?
And then what that project went bad, right? Like,
well, afterwards, I edited that footage, and you know, I was getting to the point where I was like creatively burned out.
Yeah,
and I was like, I'm just gonna start making bad decisions, and I started making bad edits, and I was like, what am I gonna do? You know, like I need a vacation, but I didn't even realize I needed a vacation. I was like gung ho about finishing what I was trying to do.
Right.
So I was clinging to the job, but I really needed a vacation to just get healthy again.
Yeah.
And so, you know, at the end of it, I was like, you know, I was basically just calling for help. I was like, look, you know, this documentary is not finished, but it's as close as I can get it. So if you want to finish it. I didn't say that. I basically told him, fuck off.
Yeah.
And then he was like, well, turn in your camera. You're done.
Yeah.
You know, cause he's professional. You can't talk to your boss that way. Even though I wanted to, I was like, just forgive me. But, he kind of shut me out. And,
cause you were basically like,
I was going insane.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was literally going insane.
Yeah.
Like, I had to go to the hospital cause I was getting paranoid. I thought somebody was going to break into the house. Like, I thought people were watching me and...
And were you still working on the project at that point?
Yeah, pretty much. But I was at the point where I was like, as much as I could edit it.
Yeah.
So that was the last thing I ever did.
Already kind of had like a mental break and were still working on the project and then just was like...
Yeah, it was like watching it. I'm like, is the video talking to me? Oh, like, fuck. You know, yeah. I was like, I was getting all these signals, like everything was meaningful, but it was my own subjective interpretation on my reality.
Right.
It wasn't anything true. It was just kind of like, you know, does red mean no?
Mm.
And when I see something red, is it telling me to stop? That's crazy.
Yeah.
You know? And for me, that was meaningful. And I was like, there's meaning everywhere, but I was insane. And,
what did that look like? Like, did you commit yourself or like how?
Well, I called my mom and I told her, Mom, I'm scared to death in my apartment. I think there's some kind of gas like being put in here that's making me like paranoid.
Yeah.
You know? And I was like, this is crazy shit.
Yeah.
And she came out she was living in Santa Barbara at the time. And she drove to Venice Beach and picked me up and tried to take me to her, house that she had, this beautiful house on the Riviera in Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
And, you know, what are we going to say? My son's mentally ill. He needs to come stay with us. And it was just like, no, you know, it's like, get your mentally ill son out of here. We don't want that.
She living with people there?
She was living with people, but I'm not saying anything bad. It's just like, you can't bring your mentally ill son in our house, like, and like, let him stay here.
Was it her like husband, stepdad? Or like
it was a really nice lady.
Got it. So she's
named Lori, and she has a beautiful house. And it was just kind of one of those things that's like, well, what's wrong? You know, what's going on now? So we went to the hospital at UCLA, and the doctor was like, "You have schizophrenia," and I was like, "Well, I don't hallucinate. You know, I don't see things or hear anything." And he's like, "And I was like, but I am distracted by a lot of things. It's like right out of that kind of thing, or right out of the editing when I quit.
Yeah.
Like I couldn't focus on anything. It was always like, the almost stereotypical version of a person that went crazy is that they're like off in outer space and like, you know, looking at a fly that's in the air and like trying to smack it, you know?
Yeah.
If you tried to have this conversation with me, I'd be like silent because I'd be like paying attention to like, is that a car alarm?
I remember the first time that I saw you after that had happened, but I didn't know about it. It was for Greg, our friend Greg's wedding, right?
I was in bad shape at Greg's wedding.
Yeah. And I remember that what you're describing is exactly what I was so excited to see you. I'm like, thanks for coming back. Like, and then I remember just like talking to you and what it felt like to me is that you were like this cool LA guy who just like wasn't listening or gave a shit. And like, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't know that you had been diagnosed with schizophrenia and were like, which is funny or interesting or sad to think that the two could be confused as, you know, I'm like, oh, Nick's just like in another world, like not paying attention or listening to, he doesn't give a shit that we're talking, you know?
Yeah. And in reality, you were dealing with this crazy thing. It's really bad because, you know, I mean, I guess this is helpful if anybody maybe, you know, I don't know if anybody, but there's bad stigma with that, you know? People hear that you have like something like that.
Mental health, like, yeah. It feels like it's come a long way since then too.
And I appreciate that, you know, anybody that's kind of supportive of that kind of thing. But at the same time, nobody really knows what it is. Like you hear that and it's like, what is that, you know?
Well, and I think like my dad's best friend is schizophrenic. And it happened right around like 22, like right around that time. And he's now in his 60s or whatever. And he's like, since then, he like lives a normal life. He like got his PhD, like lives a, you know.
Good for him.
So I remember when I found that out about you, like dealing with that, I was like crushed, you know, my heart was crushed for you. And then I remember talking to my dad about it and feeling like, well, it's not like a death sentence. You know what I mean? Like it's like
a lot of people with mental illness commit suicide.
I can. Yeah.
And it's because basically your judgment is fucked up and your reputation is fucked up.
Right.
And like, you feel like,
you don't get the support that you need.
Well, every day is like being whipped in the back to get through the next day. And right. It's it's just a lot of stigma to it, but you know, it's like you have your whole rest of your life to get through, and it's like, why do I have to finish life? Why can't I just fucking, you know,
yeah,
get on with whatever's next?
Right.
But that gets you start to thinking about religious concepts, and you know, I started believing in hell, just because, you know, schizophrenia, you know, they changed my diagnosis to bipolar, so that's a good thing. They say that I probably don't have that anymore, but whatever, I don't know. Maybe they're just trying to help or something, I don't know. But the idea is that, I was going to say that it's a lot of, subjective meaning, like I was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
And it has a lot to do with you know, you're wrong about shit. You're always wrong.
Right.
And so what I did was I capitalized off of that, and I wrote a screenplay about whatever was happening to me and whatever I thought was true.
Mm.
And I made it true fictionally. So I created something that basically, like, you know, took all my delusions and everything that I was paranoid about. And I was like, you know, who cares if it's true or not? You know, it's not true, probably.
Right.
Well, that's my.
But you can make it, you can record it into this like fictional thing.
Yeah. Well, and it doesn't matter what I think about it. The right. point is that I made something, and it's like, in fiction, it can be true.
It is real because it's fake.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, wow, that's interesting.
So that's what I had to do. And, you know, I have a finished screenplay now. It's called Targeted Individual. It's about basically people who are struggling with mental illness are actually fighting a secret war against government and basically the war on terrorism. And like, so everybody, basically society says this person has mental illness and he's crazy. Don't listen to him. Don't understand.
Yeah.
But according to him, he says, no, look, like I'm experiencing voices, which might be hallucinations.
Right.
But according to him, he says something like, you know, that's high technology. That's the future of the internet is telepathy and,
sure.
and mapping and imaging. Basically, you don't need cameras. You can watch his own vision
right.
and just see whatever the guy's seeing on a screen. And as they watch him, they communicate with him. And he's arguing this, and they're saying, no, it's mental illness. So I don't want to ruin the ending of the story. I'm going to sit on it because, you know, I mean, making a movie is not like being a punk band in the 80s. You right. can't DIY everything.
Right, right.
And if you do, it's cool, but
you're like, I wish I saw that with some money.
Well, I feel like that's practically every video I've ever made so far DIY.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of, yeah. I mean,
it's amateur at the end of the day. You know, you guys may like it. You may see the stuff that I made and say, it's cool. You're great. You've succeeded. But to me, I look at it and it's all DIY video stuff. And I'm like, that's not success. You know, I mean, it's successful, but it's amateur. And I'm in pursuit to make something that's a masterpiece.
But
your
video
for Miracle was a masterpiece, in my opinion, because it was just, you know, the shots of the band. Like it wasn't a shot of the band like you know, halfway through his set where he's not paying attention. He's got his eyes closed and he's like doing like you caught Adam like looking awesome. You caught Dan looking awesome. It was in your face. It was in their face, which makes it in the audience's face, and it was awesome.
I appreciate that. But I also do feel like it was my diamond ring. Like, you know what I mean?
Better
like,
than the diamond ring. The diamond ring, which we
No, but the only reason it's better is because it's newer. Like technology came farther. You know what I mean? Like I don't know. I mean, I appreciate the compliment.
Thank you for saying
I love it. But
I mean, the diamond ring in many ways, I treat it like my stepchild.
Yeah.
It's like, I love you and you mean a lot to me, but I didn't make you. Can that be the commercial?
The commercial?
Yeah, all right.
okay. So, fuck, where do we go from here? That knocked me off.
I don't know, man. We talked a lot about, I mean, we got into sort of some of the stuff that happened to me after.
Okay. So the movie. So, nope, that was not the right thread.
Well, the movie, you know, is, I'm not really going to pursue it.
Yeah. But I mean, it's like sort of like an exercise of like a like journaling in like this creative like way that is exclusively Nick Lambrew of like, you know.
Well, you know, I mean, being on the 30 Seconds of Mars tour and filming everything taught me how to write in some ways because it was the same, a similar approach.
Yeah.
I would sort of, you know, I didn't have a sponsor to put me through something interesting to document.
Right.
You know, like a producer probably like put me on the tour to have a topic for my film.
Right.
But like on my own, it's like if I wanted to replace the camera with a notebook, which is cooler because when you document stuff and you journal, you can create a fictional element out of it that didn't really happen.
Right.
And that can't happen while you're documenting something.
Right, right.
Yeah, you can make a story in the editing room, but when you're writing all the things that happen, you could sit there and say, a fight broke out here.
Yeah, yeah.
And it didn't really happen.
Right.
You know, so it's like, and because it is based in reality, when you return back to the real story after creating a lie within your journal,
yeah,
it's believable.
Sort of like an augmented reality. Because, like, I feel like that's how jokes are written. You know what I mean? Like, great jokes are almost always not true, but they're, like, they're inspired by... Yeah, like, you know what I mean? Like, because it's too hard to just sit down and go, okay, think of a premise. Like, you think of the premise for a joke by experiencing reality, and then you're like, but wouldn't it be funnier if X, Y, or Z thing happened? Like, okay, let me give you a joke. This just happened the other day. I'm at IKEA. I'm just noticing how the people that work there feel, to me, very unfulfilled and just like, just don't give a shit. And like, as I was thinking that, this woman comes up to me and she goes, where's the chopsticks aisle? And I was like, sorry. She goes, yeah, yeah, I'm looking for these and the thing. And I was like, oh, I don't know. She goes, don't you work here? And I was like, no, I don't work here.
That was your opportunity to say yes or something.
And yeah. She looks at me and she's like, oh, I mean, you could work here though. And I was like, thanks. And I mean, okay, I guess. Yeah. And she goes, yeah, yeah. I mean, no, I get it. You don't work here, but like, but you could though. And I'm like, yeah, 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 I get it. You
fuck
know
that bitch.
And she's like, okay, I just want you to know.
No, Jordan.
You could work here. And I'm like, you know, and it's like, anyway, it's like it's a bad example of a joke, but.
Well, it wasn't really a joke.
But I know, but I was just thinking like, oh, that's like how funny things are created is like,
yeah. Well, it's like mythology.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think the ancient Greeks, they say that myths sort of are told by stories and they evolve over time. But I think that a lot of the Greek myths were based on real events. And when they wrote it down, they just created the fiction of the gods and, you know, Athena came in and stopped him from attacking Agamemnon.
Right.
You know, and she held him by his hair. You know, they took or probably something that really happened.
And made it more interesting.
Yeah, and so that's kind of how a lot of my writing has turned out. Even though I didn't have a sponsorship, like a music tour to go document with my writing, you know.
Right.
Everything I've done since I had to go to the hospital has been on my own, and it kind of feels... I feel guilty about it.
Yeah.
Because like I haven't had a job in so long.
Yeah.
And like I feel guilty about not having a job, which I don't really give a fuck, but people like judge you, you know?
Yeah.
Like it hurts when somebody's like, fucking, you know, Nick doesn't have a job, you know, he's worthless, something like that. It's like, it hurts, but I don't really give a fuck about having a job.
Who do you think feels like that? Like,
dude, let me tell you a story.
Okay.
A week before I left for Missouri.
Yeah.
My landlord's husband comes up to me while I'm smoking a cigarette and he says, if I see you sitting here smoking next Monday, I'm going to kick you in the balls, punch you in the face and all this stuff.
Jesus.
And I'm like, you know, there's more to my story, which is that I got incarcerated. So I had been around a lot of big dudes that are threatening.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at this guy. He's kind of old. He's got a cane. He could attack me, but you know, if he did, you know, Anyway, I'll get into that later.
Sure.
But like he said, he's like, you don't have a job. You're living with your mom and she raised you really bad. And I mean, he's judging me because I don't have a job.
Right.
And you're asking who does that. And it's like my fucking landlord's husband. We pay the bills, you know, I mean, he threatened to kick my ass
yeah.
because I don't have a job. And it's like, you know, yeah, I don't have a job. I applied to Target and got denied. I mean, I was in the interview with Target and they were like, name some time you excelled in the workplace. And I'm like, well, Chino Marino was, you know, watching my work and, you know, he didn't want any changes and he's notorious for having changes. And I'm at Target, you know, yeah. And they're like, okay, you know, I don't, but they didn't call me. They told me I didn't get the job and I killed the interview. And it was like, I was way overqualified. Maybe that's why it was. Maybe it was because of my record, but
yeah,
you know, I've tried to get jobs and I don't want to work, because, you know, I mean, I came from all this cool stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, now I got to get some, you know, and there's honor in it, but I don't really, that's not the kind of honor I'm looking for.
Right.
I don't think that's honorable.
Could you do something in the creative field?
I'm so burned out. I mean, I'm hoping maybe my script gets read and I get to produce it and direct it.
Yeah.
Like that for me would be the coolest thing that would happen. But right now I'm kind
of
like,
but don't you feel out of practice? Like it's been so long since you've done something that you got to get the wheels rolling again. That.
Well, like if it's going to be computer work, I'm not going to do it. Yeah. Manual labor is kind of out because when I let go of all my responsibilities, like I feel overwhelmed by like the thought of moving that chair, like 10 feet. Like,
yeah,
it's like, I don't know if that's like, you know, if somebody's going to be like, you're lazy.
Yeah.
But like, I physically can't do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, I don't know.
Are you dealing with the mental illness?
I have a mental illness.
Right.
And I'm trying to, I don't know. But one thing I was reading, and this is, I don't know about saying this because, you know,
my listenership is vast.
Well, that's good, but they might,
I'm just kidding.
There might be some like hardcore, I don't know, conservative guys that are kind of like.
Yeah. I have a big following of those guys.
Okay. Well, there's this.
Change the channel.
Let me say this much about you know, next time some like kind of judgmental guy is talking about, you know, someone not working.
Yeah.
You know, I just got done reading the Constitution and I read about the 13th Amendment and it's basically prohibits any involuntary servitude. Mm. So, and that's in the Constitution. And I'm not trying to defend my laziness. It's partly a disability, but I feel for anybody that doesn't want to work. I defend that.
Sure.
And it's in our Constitution. So next time some conservative guy is saying, like, I want my Second Amendment right, just remember that people have the right to not work involuntarily.
Sure.
And I think that should be expanded upon. And I think that could be a key to really helping our country because I think that should be defined as if you're going to lose your house, you know, I mean, right now it's basically like, well, you don't have to work. You have that right, but you're going to be homeless and you're going to starve to death on the streets.
Right.
So you can have your right, but you're just going to die.
Yeah.
But I think we should really enforce that and say, you know, what it means to not have to involuntarily work means that you're not going to lose your house. You're not going to go homeless. You're not going to go broke. If you don't want to work, and you know, there's a lot of stuff we could talk about how the workforce can change. I think that the industries and labor worlds or labor sector of society should be an extension of college and the school system. I think, you know, full of people that care about you because teachers, they give a fuck if you fail your class. They want to see you do well. And I think we should have an element of that in the workforce. And I think it should be like the military where you, after you get out of college, you're trained specifically for a job that you basically suggest, like try out for and try to make. Mm. And then you serve about 10 years in the workforce, like almost like in the military after your training that's very specified. Like there's no going to college. I mean, sure, education and learning whatever you want to learn about is like a great thing. But there's a lot of people that have degrees that are just vague and like, have you no preparation for any real job that's very specific?
Yeah, we're going through this big change in the workforce.
I can't believe I said all that on your show in front of all your conservative fans. So they're gonna shoot me. What were you gonna say?
Well, I just think that we're going through a change and like, see, I don't know. I think you may be extrapolating though your circumstance. I think as a society, we need to help people that are dealing with an, like, mental illness is just like a physical illness. You know what I mean? Like,
it is.
If you had two broken legs, I wouldn't be like, Nick, go pick up that rock over there.
Well, it's tricky because when your mind is damaged, you know, it kind of becomes a question of, you become unpredictable. Your judgment becomes bad.
Sure.
And if you get in trouble, the courts are going to be like, you know, how much are we going to hold him accountable?
Right.
Like, to what we can we attribute to this person and their decisions and, versus what is mental illness and what are they, you know, struggling with? So
I think we'll look back at mental illness we'll look back at like the way that we held people accountable and be embarrassed and laugh at it. Like, can you believe that we used to not know that just X, Y, or Z, like that people are compelled to do things or not compelled to do things because of things that we have easy fixes for, you know, that we don't have fixes for now, but like, you know what I'm saying? Like, we know, like, if you break your leg, we're like, we'll put it in a cast, you know? And then
it's complicated because the mind is like part of,
it's just more complicated than a leg. You know what I mean? Like, the brain is harder to cast than a leg, you know?
it's a lot more complicated, and there's a billion things that can happen to your mind that may make you like not, because like, what is mental health? I mean, you'd have to be the center of all of society and like stay that way to be mentally healthy compared to anybody else.
Well, I notice it in myself. Like, if I don't get enough sleep, I feel cloudier the next day. I make poor judgment.
But
you know what I mean? Like, just at a minimum, it's just like my body doesn't work as well if I don't have sleep. Like, I can't run as fast. I can't, like, if I go to the gym, I don't perform as well. The same thing happens when I don't get sleep, when I am at the editing bay. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I think like at a minimum, like, that's mental health. You know what I mean?
Well,
like,
I think nutrition. I think film is a very, it's a sport like football.
Yeah.
Only it's in the arena of the mind.
Right.
And you have to have a very strong mind, have very strong focus. I mean, to understand humanity, you have to, I mean, what is like our interaction? How are you going to analyze it and break it down to every little thing and then put that and deal with that and be an expert at that? And you know, I mean, it's,
and then like the repetitive motions of like copying and then like moving one thing, like, and like working in frames.
Well, you
like,
have to be very focused and dedicated toward putting all your mental energy on one small thing.
Right.
And you know, film world,
24th of a second.
Film world is mental illness. I mean, you look at John Cleese, I think, who it was, it was one of the Monty Python guys.
Yeah.
And he's like, don't ever get into entertainment. It's full of fucking insane, mentally ill people. They're all insane.
Right. Pretending to be something they're not. And
Well, and it goes into, you know, I mean, in St. Louis, we have this idea where we have a dream of being special and making it and doing all that. But in LA, it's kind of like, it's kind of like, if you care about that, you're like, you know, not, you're like, you're the sucker. There's a lot, I've run into basically, evil.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think there's a lot of, I think trying to be successful, you know, from St. Louis world, it makes sense and it's like innocent. But like the reality of success of like a celebrity, I mean, a lot of celebrities try to be really nice and stuff like that. Deep down, they're probably like have a lot of hatred and they just want to be a normal person that throws something at somebody, you know, and just like wants to be like, don't judge me because that's how I feel.
Right.
But, you know,
it's a weird game that the celebrity world has to play.
I feel bad for a lot of celebrities because they have pressure to be nice and their fans abuse that, really.
Right. Yeah.
They'll be like
there's a pocket of fame where you're like, you want to be recognized a little bit, but where you can still have a personal life and that's not, you know, like your public and personal life are not one and the same, you know?
Yeah.
Adam and I talked about it, I think on, Russell on like,
yeah. Being, and the story guys are amazing guys. Cause I mean, I remember thinking like, if I ever got famous, I'm going to like go to dinner with my fans and like meet their parents and like do all this cool stuff. But you know, I mean, when you get
eventually, you just want to just go to dinner with your own family.
Yeah, I mean,
not
I mean,
your fans.
It torments celebrities.
Yeah, yeah.
They're well, like miserable.
Adam would say he would like they would go to like to the mall and they would have to like do a long walk around Hot Topic because they're like, we're just there to get something to eat and take a shit. And if we have to like talk to every single person at Hot Topic that wants to talk about a story with you, like we love our fans, but like we're like getting ready for the show.
I think if there are a lot of fans and they care about a celebrity, I think my message to you is don't expect them to be like, you know, I don't know. Like let them kind of like vent and be a human being, because they might be going through something where they want to be great to their fans, but it's just, it's a pain in the ass, like really, you know? But I mean, what I wanted to get into was like how, I think being a celebrity, you know, I'm not going to say it.
Okay.
I don't know.
We're at an hour 20.
We're at an hour 20?
Yeah.
So is it over?
I think it's over. What else? You want to get into something else? Final thoughts with Nick Lambert?
Final thought may be that, I don't know. Can we edit this part a little bit?
Yeah, we'll shut it. We'll cut it. Cut it way low.
My final thought might be about society,
yeah,
and the new economic system where, basically, you know, this is just an idea, but rather than having political revolution, rather than, you know, destroying the elite class or coming up with the argument communism versus socialism or anything, I think what would, you know, and this may seem like a socialization of the system, but if work is an extension of school and you do it like the military and you only work 10 years, then you're free basically after that to travel, raise your family, you know, all the jobs. It's a de-emphasis on your identity being associated with your work.
Right. And it's sort more, of European.
Yeah. I mean,
like when people say like in Europe, when somebody asks you like, what do? Like,
Party all summer.
Yeah, like I ride bicycles. They don't expect, like, that's not a question of like, where do you work, you know? But in America, we're like, what do you do? That means like, what do you do for employment?
Yeah, and
you know,
and,
which is a strange distinction.
You know, I think it's you know, you're not your job, and
I do feel like I'm my job, which is a weird thing. Well, but you know,
I mean. My advice to you is put an emphasis, and this may require time away with, you know, I think, sorry if I'm going over a little longer.
That's fine.
But sometimes I feel like having help from a relative or, you know, being like, you know, you grow up and you're 30 and you envision yourself with a wife and family and an apartment. Sometimes life might be more difficult.
Sure.
And you know, I'm not passionate enough to talk about this. I don't really give a fuck.
And let's end it there. No. Yeah.
You know,
no,
I mean, yeah. There's problems and I have, you know, but it's like, I don't have the energy and I don't care enough to combat the opposing view, but, I do. Well, I'm not going to say that either.
Well, let me say this. I appreciate you being on the show. And like I mentioned at the top, was inspired so heavily by what you did. And you know, have watched you deal with these struggles, and had so much, my heart has gone out to you in such a way. And like, you know, then I have this like guilt of like, I you know, wish I could make an effort to like see you more or like hang out more. And like, just my only defense in that is like, I don't hang out with like my best friends. I don't see anybody, you know what I mean? Like I'm like so in it, in this hard thing with like little kids and the job and stuff. It's just like, it's hard. And then, you know, I don't know. I just hope that like, I just hope that you keep, you know, keep pushing on and like, you know, finding that fulfillment that you have. I know you say like, you don't, you are such a creative to me though, that like, I hope that like there is a point where you can do, you know, that you get the movie made or, you know what I mean? Like that you can do something. Cause like, you know, the world's a little less special without you making shit. You know what I mean? So,
well, you know, I mean, sad to say this on the air because, you know, when you want to be, you know, I'm on the radio and I want to be talking about like how great things are going, you know, I mean, it's, yeah. Nobody wants to hear some dude just be like, I got problems, you know,
and
put that on the loudspeaker. It's not very good, but
it feels good though. It's just like you listen to Wolves. It's like when you hear Dan talk about his struggles, I think people, you know, will relate to like listening to you deal with your struggles. You know what I mean?
It's embarrassing to come on here and say, you know, I've got problems.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the same time, it's like, I'm dead on the air.
Well,
I don't know how many people are still listening to this by the end of this.
We might edit it down into a super cut.
You're going to have a hard time editing. I was trying to avoid that, but I mean,
we're pretty good the whole time. We just, you know, the shit gets weird at the end, you know, with the, you know,
I don't know how many, never mind. I'm not going to say that.
All right. Let's take it there. Dude, Nick, again, I love you, man. I appreciate you being here. Instagram, where can people find you?
Yeah. My Instagram, Nick Lambrew. It's got all these photos that have told a really rich story about the past, you know, couple years of my life, you know. So I think all those stories or all those pictures have a dimension.
Sure.
And I don't know.
One day I hope that I can write and direct your life story because it's fucking wild. I mean, we scratched the surface here, but like, well, it's funny. I told you that.
To it. I wrote about my life.
Well, I know. I told you I wanted to make it, and you go, you said something hilarious about like,
you need $1 billion.
Yeah, for all the licensing rights.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. All right. Again, he is Nick Lambrew, director, editor, friend, and we'll see you guys next week. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Jordan.